Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 311 of the Roguecast, recorded November 4th, 2020. Fast and Furious and Insidious.
All right, we are back after skipping a week last week. We were all super tired.
Yep.
This week,
there's nothing going on this week.
All super tired.
Not me, I actually got sleep last night.
Nick got sleep.
Mr. Fancy.
Yeah. The rest of us were up at 4 a.m. talking about Facebook. Yeah. One of us should probably go to sleep.
Yep, that was pretty funny.
I mean, I've been there.
Yeah.
Believe me, I've been there.
All right, well, we'll try and be there next time, Nick.
We missed you.
We were like, we wanted to all be in misery today, and instead it's just most of us.
I've somehow retrained my dog, and she wakes up at 8 now, so yeah. Instead of 5 o'clock in the morning. So, I know. So, somehow I hit the reset button with her.
Oh, nice.
So, I don't know.
So yeah, we did skip last week. We'll talk real quick about last week's books, because it was kind of a notable week.
There's a few big ones.
And we'll mention that when we get to comics. But first, we'll talk about the games that have been coming in. So, some notable stuff. Pandemic Legacy Season 0 came in.
Those of you who are needing more pandemic in your life.
Pandemic in your life.
You know what's funny? All the main pandemic games have done well during the pandemic.
Yeah, sure.
Because, well, A, they're a good game. B, people have a dark sense of humor.
Yeah.
And yes, this new one, we played Pandemic Legacy before, the ones that...
We played Season 1 and 2.
What do you play? You get, like, what, 15 to 25 games out of it, no matter what?
It's somewhere between... 12 and 24.
And our experience has been pretty good with these, and sometimes great.
Yep.
And they're just like nothing else, these legacy games.
I love legacy games. I definitely will be picking this one up. It's just right now it's hard to get four people together in a room. Yeah.
And this has a unique thing. So the first one was just kind of classic Pandemic, but then it built into this cool storyline that like it's like they ran with the story.
Yep.
Then the second one was like set in a sort of dystopian future where you had to like reestablish communication lines across the whole world, and it was all Mad Max-y.
Sort of post-apocalyptic,
and so now, what do we got in the new one?
So this is a prequel. It is as Season 0 would imply, and it takes place in the 60s and it's Cold War spies. So there is a pandemic element, but the cubes of the disease are communist spies. And you are all CIA team, and you put together, instead of like putting together cures, you put together teams for missions and that kind
That's
of stuff.
Cool.
It looks super cool.
It kind of reminds me, like in a roundabout way, this was just kind of a simple reskinning. One of my favorite things about the Call of Cthulhu one that they did was where they took what had been the medic's ability to heal away a whole town of cubes or a whole city of cubes, and it became the hunter, I think.
Kill all the Shuggoths.
It was cultists.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what masked as the cubes in there, and you would just go in and this the hunter would just clean them out.
Now you're a guy who just kills all the communists in a city.
Yeah.
Just literally wipes them out.
For all your right-wing fantasies. playing around in sort of like putting together missions in a kind of Bond type environment. I assume it's got like some Cold War fun to it.
It looks like, yeah.
Hopefully more of the Cold War fun parts and less the Cold War gloom and doom parts.
Yeah, probably so.
Less Cuban Missile Crisis, more
James Bond.
I Expect You to Die, Mr. Bond.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it looks super cool, and I like the concept behind it.
Also, Mysterium Park, which is a sort of a stripped down version of the game Mysterium. But it seems to involve a park owner of like an amusement park who died and stole ghosts and
Mysterium, for those who don't know, is like a sort of reverse Clue where one person is the ghost of the dead person who cannot talk during the game. Well, more than like little snippets here and there, but and has to use these cards that have abstract images to try and give clues to the players who killed him, what they killed him with, and where they killed him. Just like I said, like a reverse Clue, and it's a very cool spin on that kind of concept.
We also got Time Stories Midsummer Night, which is a standalone, seems like a time travel into, like, Shakespeare times?
I think so. I actually haven't had a chance to look at it, but it's definitely up my alley, so I'll have to investigate it.
And that's a standalone. You don't have to have the other time stories. They sort of reconfigured that so you can buy them individually.
It's very cool.
Warp's Edge, which is the new solo hero series, which is a solo game about sort of, like, space travel, fighter combat, that kind of thing. That looks super, super cool. And then a couple role-playing game things.
Wait, do you mean, like, did you say solo, like, one-player game?
One player.
Oh, how neat. Like, straight up built that way.
We got the Tome of Beasts 2 from Green Ronin. I think Green Ronin? No. Cold Press,
yeah. Known for their very innovative monsters and stuff like that.
Great art in this one. Lots of fun monsters. They have the Ogrepede,
Ogre Centipede.
Yeah, it's a 14-legged ogre monster.
It looks cool. Like the art in it is like the at the level that you would expect of either Paizo or Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah.
And the whole concept, other than just to like have some spice, is also, of course, to throw at players who might well know the Monster Manual back and forth, just from, especially if they're DMing themselves, to throw stuff that they have no idea what it is right. at them.
And right before we started recording, we got the Animal Adventures RPG starter set, which is the D&D Dungeons and Doggos thing.
Yeah,
this looks so cool.
You get little plastic doggo minis with weapons and armor. There's a GM screen.
And this is like it's the not starter.
Just dogs. This is a split party. This is dogs and cats.
Nice.
The cats are the warlock,
the rogue feels like it should be.
The warlock rogue, and it was another kind of. Oh, crap. I can't remember the other class. Huh?
Is it the bard?
No, the dog's a bard.
Okay, alright.
I forget what the other kind of sneaky class it is. Yeah. The dogs are the paladins and the bards.
But it's
the
like clerics. It's a standalone game.
Like it's a box set, just like those other starter box set games. Like there's a D&D starter, there's a Call of Cthulhu one, there's a Shadowrun. So now I don't know what the age recommendation on this is.
I don't either.
I'm betting they're going to say like 10 and up or maybe 12 and up or something. But it does seem like the one where you're playing heroic dogs and cat warriors and wizards seems like it could be a neat intro game for kids. Mm-hmm. And I'd play it.
Yep.
Yeah,
I think Anna's playing it.
So. Yeah. so we're playing it.
All right. Let's move on to news of the week. Let's start. We sort of referenced this in our Pandemic Legacy. Expecting You to Die, James Bond. Bond did die. Sean Connery passed at age 90.
Right.
Yep.
Connery, for those who may not know, had a bit of a reputation as someone who hit women.
Yep.
I've seen this got sort of passed over in a lot of my fan friend groups. And I didn't want to like crap on anybody's parade, so I let it go for a day. And then I was like, "Hey, by the way, guys, he may not have been the best person to celebrate, but for all that he may have been kind of a crap person, he was a good actor in a lot of good movies."
Right. I think we all basically bonded with a lot of his movies early on, kind of generally knowing nothing about him. Yeah. I'm sure, other than he was the coolest first Bond. He was the great cop that he won the Oscar for in Untouchables.
And then he was the Scottish Spaniard Highlander.
Yep.
And then he was the Scottish Russian in Hunt for Red October.
He was Ramius.
And Jim Malone in Untouchables.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was the Scottish Irishman in Untouchables. He was the Scottish Russian in Hunt for Red October. He was the Scottish Spaniard in...
yes. Yeah, that guy never worked too hard to turn off his Scottish accent.
Nope.
But it's kind of he always had that on-screen magnetism and charisma. So he was regardless of a personal life that it sounds like well worth questioning and interrogating. He was a giant of the screen.
Yeah, and especially in the genre. I mean, he also played King, the King at the end of the Robin Hood movie that Kevin Costner did. Like,
there was like also movies like, was it The Man Who Would Be King?
Yes, Man Who Would Be King.
Let's not forget Zardoz.
Zardoz.
Yeah, if you have not, so if you're not familiar with Zardoz, just type Google Zardoz.
Or don't.
You'll get more Sean Connery skin than you've ever wanted to see.
And I'm going to make a suggestion.
Yeah.
Watch the movie that killed his career.
Oh,
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, currently on Amazon Prime.
Oh. I'm going to make a recommendation. Don't do either of those things that Dave and Nick just recommended. Live your life in happy ignorance.
Zardoz
is that's a cool costume. It's a bizarre movie.
It is. I have seen the Zardoz, and it is a weird indie... late or early 70s movie that's like balls trippy from John Borman, the director of Deliverance and Excalibur. It's like this trippy sci-fi fantasy dystopia sextopia.
Yeah.
There's like weird sex and violence in it. It's also like kind of almost artsy, wouldn't you say, Nick?
Yeah, it is.
Like it's like, I remember there's like some part where somebody's quoting James Joyce. Because remember Sean Connery's thing is like he's read all the books in the library, even though he looks like he's like a crazy future barbarian bandit man. Anyway, don't actually see Zardoz.
Also, he played an older James Bond in The Rock.
Yep.
At James Bond, who was caught for espionage.
I would also say.
And then he played Henry Jones.
Oh, he was he was Indiana Jones' dad.
My dark horse of this, and this is actually a great movie, is The Great Train Robbery, the Michael Crichton book that he... it was him and Donald Sutherland.
I have neither read the book nor seen the movie, but that's a good cast.
They're both good.
Yeah, Donald Sutherland's a fantastic actor.
All right, so we also... There's a new trailer out for the Animaniacs reboot that's coming on Hulu.
It's like 13 episodes?
Yep, 13 episodes. I think when Dave and I watched it, we're like, oh, this is the trailer we watched. Because there's been a couple different ones.
Right. This one, like, showed more scenes and gags, and it wasn't just a tone trailer.
Right.
The previous one I saw that was a tone trailer was good, but this one was hilarious.
Yeah, some really funny stuff.
And, like... you know, was meta in the way that the Animaniacs actually always were, mm-hmm. acknowledging that they've been out of the picture for a while. They're catching up on stuff. One of them eats, like...
A tablet
and regurgitates a bunch of pop culture stuff from the internet all at once.
Pinky has a foam party.
Yes.
Yeah, they're doing Pinky in the Brain again, which is great.
Yeah, basically, it'll be Animaniacs with Pinky in the Brain, yeah. Which is fantastic.
Well, I hope they bring along some of their other characters, too. I love the Animaniacs. It was one of my, like, go-to cartoons. Mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg did an amazing job.
You know, I did not watch Animaniacs in its day. Mm-hmm. When did it originally run? Blank to blank.
90s.
It was, like, 95 early
90s. 95 to 98, 94, 98.
Somewhere around
like
there.
That.
Yeah.
Because... As a kid, G.I. Joe and Transformers were definitely my thing. But yep. As an older kid, Animaniacs, the humor there just for some reason hit the mark with me.
I was in my early 20s at the time, maybe.
Yeah.
And I at a certain point, I started watching with my roommate Pinky and the Brain specifically because there was like its own show,
They had a spinoff and they did Pinky and the Brain.
Right, and I loved that. And then I would catch bits and pieces of Animaniacs, and in the years of that became the YouTube years later, like a lot of that stuff just makes the rounds. You know, certainly the names of the countries mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Some of their best segments will make the rounds.
Probably not the Goodfeather segments.
Not so much.
Oh man,
just two one note.
You know what else? This reminds me. Right before Animaniacs, they did Tiny Toon Adventures.
Yeah, that's getting a revival.
Yeah, but apparently the voice actress for Elmira. Was like sad that there's no Elmira in the Tiny Toon reboot. We're like, I don't know if a character based around animal cruelty is really the thing we need to come back. Nobody's favorite segments were the Elmira segments. See the Goodfeathers. Nobody's sad to see the Goodfeathers gone.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't even timely when they did it. It was a Goodfellas.
Wasn't there a little girl, a little baby, and a dog that was constantly saving him?
Mindy and Buttons.
That I would be okay with bringing back. Mindy and Buttons was fine.
And then, was the Singing Cat by Bernadette Peters in this or Tiny Toon Adventures?
It was Animaniacs.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah.
Interesting.
That was kind of fun.
That was fun.
I could see them doing some little, sneaking in some of those in there, even if they haven't made a point of it.
Well, I'm glad we're getting the entire regular voice cast coming back and doing their
own.
Yeah.
Watch the trailer. It's a ton of fun.
Yeah.
Sure. And if you liked it, I suspect it looks like they're going to capture the magic.
Fast and Furious. There was an announcement that the Fast and Furious series will end with movie number 11, which is going to be written and directed by Justin Lin.
What are they on now?
They're currently on 9.
Yeah, 9.
So two more. So essentially 3 more to go.
Yep.
That are really unseen.
Yep. And then they're going to do spinoffs.
Well, did they say in this article that 11 was a 2-part movie?
I don't think so.
I've heard that the
11
final
is a
one
weird number to stop on. 12 is not.
I've heard that the final movie is actually 2 movies.
Okay, that would make sense.
Because they're going to do the whole Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings kind of thing.
I kind of love it. Like, it's just too epic to contain. I hope that they're still kind of brisk movies, because I don't necessarily want two and a half hour movies.
I've heard that they're going to space in the next one. For sure.
What?
The next one? You mean 10?
Yeah. Or no, 9 is what I heard.
There's nothing in the trailer about space.
Or no, not 9. In number 10. You're right.
Yeah.
In number 10, one of the cast members did say that they were going to go to space.
I have to wonder if they're just screwing with us.
I mean, I hope so, because it's really weird. But if you go to space, how do you one-up yourself? You go to Mars?
No, Dimension.
Oh, alternate dimension. It's interesting.
Edge of the Furious first.
I think that is at the end of the final one... They crash through into another dimension, and they begin intersecting with other franchises. Any franchise that's willing to play ball gets to get cars driven through it like a maniac.
Look, I've been advocating Fast and Furious Mission Impossible crossovers for a long time.
I don't know if Tom Cruise would stoop.
Mission Furious?
Mission Furious. The Fast and the Impossible.
Listen, there is something appealing about the notion of any of these characters running up against the lunkheads and weirdos.
Can I pitch another one to you?
Yeah.
Fast and Furious and Insidious.
Only Dom can take down this. They
have to race through the further.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's some very scary driving sequences
and Lin Shaye, what's her character's name? The older woman.
Yeah,
she's definitely gonna drive
She's got a Dragula.
No, she's got the big she's got the big bus. They've got the RV.
That's true.
And Angus have.
Do y'all know the? I guess was infamously the biggest scare in Haunting of Hill House, the thing in the back seat while the two sisters argue.
Oh yeah.
You know this. They were arguing in the car, and like I think it was the ghost of the mom. Like her like ghoulish face came out in between them as if she had been in the back seat, made them skid just up. It's like the scariest jump scare in it.
Yeah.
And there's like videos out there of people watching it and hitting that scene. That could go right into a Fast and an Insidious type of movie.
Also, Fast and Furious. It's crazy they haven't done a Family Feud. They're all about family.
That's true. I should work on that.
I'm just saying, there's no way this should end. It should just keep going forever.
But
technically, they did have a family feud in 8 because Dom was working against the family.
That's true.
Survey says.
I'm furious in the Brady Bunch.
Anyway, we're all fans. 12, I think, is a good run. I would probably be okay if they just ended it there. But
I just want more Hobbs and Shaw.
You're going to get more Hobbs and Shaw.
Cool. What do we got next? All right.
Oscar Isaac has been cast as Moon Knight.
Oh, yeah. That's big for a Disney Plus TV
really
show.
Big, yeah. So they've
He's going to stoop to doing TV.
So we don't know who our She-Hulk is because they uncast that one.
Tatiana Maslany.
They're doing She-Hulk, Miss Marvel, Moon Knight, and I feel like something else new is coming from
Didn't
that.
Didn't they say a S.H.I.E.L.D. show or a Samuel Jackson?
They were talking about Samuel Jackson Fury show, yeah.
Yeah.
We don't know when, we don't know what the premise will be, we don't know what they're going to do, but Oscar Isaac, that's great, it's great casting.
He's a top-notch actor.
Well, here's the thing, here's the dark reason why he might be taking this, is that we don't know if movies are going to survive, and Hollywood is going to be turning into something very differently with movie theaters closing, so moving to the small screen is probably not a bad jump.
You know, it'll probably be... Things will probably change in a way we can't expect, so let me just pitch this possibility. Welcome back, Vaudeville.
I think he's waiting on Denis Villeneuve to finish reading Dune so they can finish the filming.
Right, they'll eventually get to Dune finished as long as he can finish the novel.
I saw you posted that the other day, and I'm correct.
Yeah.
This is how holodecks get involved, guys. Everything's going to be holodeck entertainment. Joe Piscopo's going to teach us how to do comedy.
I mean, there's worse things. Hey, it worked for Data is all I'm saying.
Arguably, Data went like 7 seasons and several movies without ever hitting it.
When you get talk comedy by Joe Piscopo. All right.
That's why they had to kill him in Nemesis.
Joe Piscopo?
It's a cut scene, but it's there.
Last bit of news, Strange Challenge of Luther Strode has been developed as a movie. This is basically a kid sends off for like a Charles Atlas book and becomes like a powerful death machine.
It's an Image comic, right?
And then finds out that there's actually all kinds of people with these powers. And
it becomes the world's bloodiest comic.
Yeah. This was the first time I saw Justin Jordan as a writer.
Yeah.
And Trad Moore as an artist. Both of them have gone on to do with a lot of other stuff. I think this will make a fun movie. I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Yeah, I agree.
Who do you think would be good for it? Like the guy who directed... Kingsman or something?
That's Matt.
Matthew Vaughn.
Matthew Vaughn. I would actually also say the guy who did Crank.
Yeah, I can see
or
that.
Or Tim Miller. Miller would be good, too.
Or like an old boy type director. Who's you know, those type of guys.
Oh, wow. Like a Korean director?
Yeah, I think you'd want somebody who can do violent action.
Yeah, it is like crazy over the top violent. It's like both cartoony and super violent.
Yeah.
A little like Invincible, I guess.
Something like, yeah.
But it's like less. It's not a superhero thing per se.
Yeah. I mean, there are superpowers. Like he's super strong. He's not just like regular strong.
Isn't there like a Society of Assassins or something?
Yeah, it's like a Society of Assassins. It's a little bit. of like Wanted or
Kick-Ass,
but done better.
Yeah.
In about 20 years, of course, the Fast and Furious will be crossing over into it.
Yep. The strange tale of the Fast and Furious and Luther Strode.
I don't think Justin Jordan will be sad about that.
No, no. It won't be. Yeah, anyway. Fast and Furious and Star Trek The Next Generation. All right. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics for last week's of October 28th and November 4th. So last week, we were all tired, so we didn't do a podcast. But there were comics. Maybe notably, Three Jokers number 3 came out, and we have now all read Three Jokers number 1 through 3.
Yep.
And we still have Three Jokers 1 through 3. We have
but
all
it is regularly selling. Somebody today picked up all three copies. Our buddy Rico came by.
You can buy the set now.
And while I was telling him about it, somebody else clearly overheard me telling him what the basic premise was, and that person picked up all three of them. And so, like, it's moving pretty saucily.
Yeah, it's the rare DC comic I actually read.
Yep, and I think we all enjoyed to one degree or another.
Yeah, it's
maybe
good.
We weren't like completely in love with it, but there's like there's much to be said for it. And if you kind of want a gritty Batman mystery that does have some sort of big mythology stuff if they use this in the DC universe to come. But if nothing else, is like a kind of an intriguing story that zeroes in on, was it Batman? Red Hood and Batgirl. Yeah, on like a, really, I think a single night's super intense story. Yeah.
What's interesting is it feels like a companion piece to Killing Joke.
Right. It is absolutely in the style of and even drawn in the style of. And like, who did the art?
It's like Jason Fabok. That was fantastic art.
It is so good.
And also, it references story beats from Killing Joke, which I was.
That's true. I would recommend if you want the full experience, probably read Killing Joke first.
And maybe Lonely Place of Dying? What's the one that
where Robin died?
Death in the Family,
right. Which was a later thing.
Yeah, Death in the Family, because it definitely heavily references that as well.
Yeah,
Killing Joke. This feels like a sequel to both of those in some ways.
Yep,
it was good. I liked it. Also, last week we had the latest of Black Hammer ended. That's Jeff Lemire's superhero homage book. But he's going to keep doing some side projects and stuff. So this is Colonel Weird Cosmagog, which is his sort of like...
His Adam Strange.
It's his Adam Strange, but it's more than that. It's also like Shade the Changing Man a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
The Weird Other Dimension.
Yeah. All of the heroes in Black Hammer, or many of them, were slight amalgamations of like a Marvel or DC idea, or kind of two ideas kind of like brought together.
Yeah.
And by the way, who drew this?
Good. I'm blanking, but it was good.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's something of what we've kind of come to expect from him, which is a combination of, like, kind of genre tropes, but, like, with a, like, a high degree of introspection and sort of internal thoughts.
Yeah.
It's also, like, a brisk read. Like a lot of Jeff Lemire's stuff, he lets the art breathe and stuff. And, I enjoyed it quite a bit.
And also, we are, of course, sold out of it, as everyone else. But TMNT Last Ronin came out.
Yep, that was one that people were looking forward to, and then we were allocated on. And we did the best we could. It's still sold out in the first day. But yes, this is the for lack of a better word, like the Dark Knight Returns of Ninja Turtles. Dark future with only one surviving turtle, and there's some mysteries and things to discover about who made it. And it is also a very action-oriented one. Like, it sort of reveals its world through a big infiltration because, like, it's a world that's kind of controlled by, like, what, the grandson of
Shredder, yeah.
Of Shredder. Yeah. And actually, I say world, but it's, like, this is set in very specifically in, like, some megalopolis, but it's, like, isn't it, like, Manhattan or...
It's future New York, yeah, for sure.
Which is, you know, so their hangout.
It looks like the Mega City one from Judge Dredd.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, it's like the bad guy. It's a bad guys of one kind of future.
Yeah, yep.
And, but I think it's going to, I think it delivers on what people are going to kind of want out of this. The art's cool in it. And how long does that run?
5 issues.
Five issues. Yeah, they're oversized too. So, which is why we have bags and boards for magazines prepared for them. It's the only thing that can handle their girth.
And the last thing from last week, Vault Comics has a new book called Giga, which is about these sort of giant mechs and a weird, like, they stopped fighting. They were like...
It was in the future, and, like, Earth was, like, devastated by fighting of mechs that they didn't know where they came from.
Yeah.
Like, there wasn't like, one was Russian and one was American. Yep. It's like, we don't know where they came from. But then one day they just, like, shut down, yep, I think.
And, like, a religion has sprung up around
them. Right, that people think of them in a godlike way.
And they live inside
them. They live inside them because they're so big, it's like cityscapes.
Yeah.
This is kind of a dark story.
Yeah.
But like, also, like, highly imaginative, too. Oh, and nice art on that. I don't know who the artist was, but...
All right, let's talk about this week's comics.
Yep.
And let's start off with the one that I've been really anticipating, which is crossover number one. This is Donnie Cates, Jeff Shaw, the people who did God Country.
Yeah. There's a sort of... And Donnie Cates, people have been really kind of falling into his Marvel work lately, so
especially
I think...
Thor.
Yeah, anybody who's been doing that, and that and Venom, too, should check out his indie stuff at this point. It's a good time to.
Yeah.
And the title crossover is a direct reference to, like, superhero crossovers. It's kind of his indie spin on what these kind of world-shaking events, A, might look like from the perspective of sort of the average guy on the street who has no idea what the F is going on.
Right.
But B, it's kind of a sort of what happens after one of the crossovers. Randy...
It's kind of a meta thing, too, because...
So basically, like, superheroes, like, all the different heroes, and he makes reference to, he's like...
Shazam,
he's
Thor.
Like, green men with fins on their head, men dressed as bats, spiders are gods with giant hammers. Basically, he's like, all the superheroes from all the worlds showed up, there's a big knockdown dragout, and the superheroes themselves shielded this world, which appears to be in, like, Utah.
Colorado?
It's in Colorado. They basically shielded Denver with this force field so nobody can get in and out. But there's this weird crossover going on to this day. And as a result, superheroes and comic books have become like, people are protesting them.
Religious groups target them.
Yep.
Comic shops are considered the, like, dens of scumbaggery.
Well, they're the devil comics now.
Yeah.
And their lead character is a girl named Ellie, who is a cosplayer, and she works at this comic shop. And for her, she's still a true believer in comics. And so there's a little bit of meta as she goes to this comic shop, and then the sort of crossover stuff comes to her.
Yep.
It's really good. It's a very, like, no other book is like this.
Right. It also begins with the best two juxtaposed quotes I've ever seen in a comic, and I feel like people should read it for that alone.
Yep.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. I mean... It was a very interesting idea.
Well, and also, you know, Donnie Cates is a guy who's now, I don't know how long he's been in the biz, 5 years, 10 years?
He's been in the biz a long time.
I mean, yeah, most people don't, like, become hits overnight, but I don't know if he's been in there more than 10 years. But in any case, he knows what's going on. He's been ground zero at Marvel for a while now. He's himself done some crossover stuff. So it's interesting.
Coming out in the next month.
Yep, it's interesting to see him... Like, presumably this is not going to be just a, you know, crossovers are just cheap, crass events and there's, you know, nothing of merit in them. This is a guy who likes superheroes, too, and he likes indie comics, and he's going to find some way to talk about both.
Yeah. Yep. Nick, I know you read Wolverine Black, White, and Red.
Yeah.
Or is it called Black, White, and Blood?
Black, White, and Blood, I believe is what it is.
Black, White, and Blood.
Yep.
And the Furious.
And the Furious.
And the Furious.
And Insidious.
Yeah, this is actually like a trio of stories. One written by Jerry Dugan, one written by Matthew Rosenberg, and then a final story written and drawn by Declan Shelvey.
But it's it's the first of a mini series, right? So
yeah,
every issue
only...
is going to have different people?
Yeah, it's basically a series of vignettes, sort of like what Batman Black and White was.
Right.
Yeah.
None of these will continue in the next one.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, they're all done in ones. Like, the first story is a tale from his Weapon X days where he was first trained and fighting the Wendigo, which is a pretty stellarly drawn by, I believe, Adam Kubert. Yep.
He looked all crazy feral there.
Yeah, he's, like, super feral in his helmet and shirtless. you get to see everything on Wolverine. no, I'm kidding.
I was saying that the Wendigo looked feral.
Oh, the Wendigo looked feral. Okay. The Wendigo one is pretty cool. The second story is drawn by...
The Wendigo.
Joshua Cassara, and is a Wolverine and Nick Fury versus Hydra story, which is actually really a really fun one. The art is gorgeous. And then the final one by Declan Shelvey is sort of a more personal one. If you know Declan Shelvey, his artwork is always stunning. He's actually a solid writer as well.
Okay.
But yeah, I think this is, if you're a Wolverine fan, this is a no-brainer. I mean, definitely see.
Did we say that it is literally in black and white with red accents for the blood?
Yes. Like, not blood.
I mean, it in my head, it is very reminiscent of
Batman Black and White.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about the Weapon X Wolverine book that
Barry Windsor Smith.
Barry Windsor Smith. In my brain, it's like I always see the black blood, so it kind of it feels like it. But yeah, it's a very violent book.
All right, so it sounds like I feel like that's going to be a crowd pleaser enough for Wolverine fans.
Dave, I know you read Stranger Things and Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, I actually quite enjoyed this.
Yeah.
You know, Stranger Things, of course, I mean, like, all but responsible for D&D 5th Edition, which itself is a very good edition, but, like, it's mega success. I think half this and half Critical Role, like, where Stranger Things was responsible. And this is a flashback story, so it's before all the crazy stuff happened in Hawkins, Indiana. And it's actually sort of about the first time they meet with, hang out with Dustin.
Yep.
But prior to that, it shows them getting their first D&D game. The kids in there where, like, literally, like, they hear about it because they see, is it their teacher or the librarian? Or
it's like a bookstore owner.
Oh,
that they're being chased by a bunch of mean kids, bullies.
That's almost like itself an homage to the Neverending Story.
Yeah.
He hides out in a bookstore from bullies.
Yeah, and they go in like the back door of a bookshop, and
it is actually how like I remember old used bookstores looked in the 80s with bending shelves and books and stuff. And they see this guy has like all these like an elaborate like pool table sized Napoleonic War setup.
Yep.
And then one of the kids is like, wait, what's this one? And it's like, you know, like an ogre or something like that.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, that's a different kind of game. But it was like from the era when D&D was kind of like transitioning from war game enthusiasts to the concept of role-playing games. And they're super excited to try it out but have no money. And this issue is kind of about them trying to find stuff that they can sell to the bookstore, like, and having a like almost like a little mini adventure with that. To afford it, and then doesn't quite work out, and they kind of end up having to do something else. And it also shows you their sort of first forays into the game. Like, you even see one of them reading word for word. It's like what it says on, like, the D&D starter, the red box, the original red box.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about how, like, they started to use the game, among other things, to decode the world around them, where you'll see, like... there's like a teacher that looks like she's kind of like a real snobby teacher, and they tag her as Intellect Devourer.
Yep.
They see a gym coach as Berserker, the jocks as Trolls. You know, anybody who's played D&D knows you do kind of start using it as a way to lens thing, like, oh, I critically failed something or another.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, this is the start of a mini-series. It is written by
Jody Hauser,
who wrote the Stranger Things comics.
But it's co-written by Jim Zub.
And co-written notably by Jim Zub, who's been doing D&D comics for like 5-6 years or something.
Yeah.
So I think it is a kind of a fun best-of-all-worlds thing, and I don't know quite where they're going to continue with it, this issue is definitely their introduction issue. Also shows how like Dustin connects with it because of like the nerdy math side of it. He's able to kind of figure out the probabilities and stuff. But
it feels like the two writers got the voices. For
yeah,
the
I think
it feels
so.
A piece of the show, which is important.
So yeah, I'm giving it the recommends.
Yeah, I agree.
Did anybody else read this Web of Venom?
I didn't get a chance.
So this is Web of Venom Empires, and it is basically like an alien story in space. Like it is.
This is a lead into Donny Cates' crossover, right?
Yes. So the alien, the empire of the Kree and the Skrull has now become one big empire, and they happen upon some caskets from their or life pods from the Kree Skrull. They bring them aboard. It turns out they're full of symbiotes.
That's a worst case scenario.
The symbiotes start tearing their way through the ship. So it is very much like an alien, like. These things are infecting them.
Sure.
And it is about the sort of the heroes of the Korean Skrull Empire. It leads into what's coming up with Null and the King in Black that's coming this summer. But it was really good. I liked it. Nice and atmospheric. You don't have to know anything about the Venom stuff or Empire to read it, as with all these sort of one-shots.
Randy, I know you and I in particular are like kind of like, I'm going to say anti-Venom fans.
Yes.
Nick, you have some fondness for Venom?
As a kid, yeah, I did like him. I grew to hate him, but I've come around. Basically gone full circle.
Right. I kind of like the role he occupies as a sort of spooky villain or protector or whatever at times. And the idea of using symbiotes kind of like aliens and things like that.
Yeah.
Like, the lore that they sometimes will just drop into the Marvel Universe is lore that I've kind of ended up liking. I think writers, when they use it carefully, can use it well, so I don't resent it anymore.
Right.
And I'm even, I'd say, open to it. So, yeah, that sounds cool.
I also, there's U.S. Agent number one, which is, this is their, he's like their right-wing cap, basically.
Yeah.
And they put him in some kind of witness protection detail, and he gets called away to a mission.
It's written, I think the notable thing for people who might have an interest in this is that it's written by Christopher Priest.
Yep.
Yep.
Who, of course, you know, best known for sort of some of his 90s books, like the overhaul of Black Panther, which became one of the key overhauls. It added the Dora Milaje.
Yep.
And what's the FBI guy or CIA guy?
Man, I just blanked his name. Everett Ross.
Yeah, Everett Ross. And then he also did, like, Quantum and Woody over at Valiant and stuff like that. If you want to see a guy who might not be in complete alignment with U.S. agents' own motivations writing the book, then you might want to check it out.
A couple number ones from Ahoy Comics and Boom. Happy Hour, which is sort of a weird sci-fi one, and Origins, which has really nice art and is sort of a nature has reclaimed the planet sort of post-apocalyptic thing. And then I want to mention TKO has their Wave 3 books. We got all their Wave 1 and 2 graphic novels. It does have some pretty successful stuff. They've got Sentient by Jeff Lemire.
Their whole thing is that they do original graphic novels that are usually, like, a little oversized.
Well, they put them out as single issues.
Oh, that's right.
We don't tend to get them as single issues. We just get the graphic novels.
Yeah, but they always have, like, pretty rock-solid creative teams with, like, a really good, strong, beautiful art.
Yep. So the ones we got, Lonesome Days, Savage Nights, which is sort of a Steve Niles book.
It's a werewolf thing, right?
It's a werewolf detective thing, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that one's interesting. The Pole, which is a sci-fi book about what would you do if you had 6 days left to live, that is Steve Orlando, who you might know from Wonder Woman, Martian Manhunter. And then Red Fork, which is like a supernatural thriller about an ex-con returning to a coal mining town, discovering it on the decline, and maybe there's something sinister going on. It was written by Alex Packnadel, who's done some stuff for, like, Boom and Archaea. But it reminds me a little bit of that Hill House book that we liked. Not Daphne Byrne.
It was not Daphne Byrne. I actually picked up the graphic novel.
The Low, Low Woods.
The Low, Low Woods, which I actually bought the graphic novel to the other day and have not sit down with to read yet. But, yes, I always like a creepy coal mining town. Yep. That's also, that's like, got a foot in Silent Hill, too.
Yeah. Other stuff on my list, latest issue of Thor, which is great, so that's a new story. Latest issue of Cyberpunk 2077, Amazing Spider-Man 51.LR, New Black Widow, next part of Rise of Ultraman, an issue of Firepower, and the Swing Volume 3 graphic novel from Top Cow, which has always been good. Also a new Avatar Library Edition, which has The Lost Adventures and Team Avatar Tales, which are a bunch of short stories from, like, before the show and after the show.
Right.
What else is on y'all's reading list?
Just going to quick mention the second issue of Neil Gaiman's Norse Mythology series is out. That runs the each issue has like maybe two stories in it that are adapted from that, and one continues from the previous issue. And they have a variety of creators. So like the first one had Mike Mignola, then and stuff from. P. Craig Russell is kind of doing the bridging story stuff. Jerry Ordway is doing this story about where that's one of the famous ones that is the, like how Loki, like Sif lost her golden hair, and then Loki had to create this contest to make the dwarves give her like new hair.
Yeah.
And it ended up like in the contest, like all the coolest weapons and gear and stuff that from Norse mythology are all made by the dwarves in this story. And then I just want to mention that the Orville comic, which is, I haven't had a chance to read this yet, but has been a good one. The issue 3 of this starts a new storyline. It seems like they're doing 2-issue storylines, each one of which feels like it'd be a good episode.
That's good. So, I like that. Yeah.
I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to broadly recommend it anyway. Nick, anything else to add to the mix?
There was an issue of Batman that introduced a new character.
Ghostmaker.
Yes, Ghostmaker.
Ghostmaker has a cool costume.
He does have a cool costume.
He does.
And then there's a new Power Rangers series called Mighty Morphin.
Right.
a launch today that features the entire cast, even another Green Ranger, which I didn't know existed. But
I don't know Power Rangers.
And then the next two parts of Ten of Swords, the X-Men, which goes into sort of the history of Apocalypse, which I thought was really interesting. And then an issue of Marauders, which is sort of like a bit of a kind of right before all the tournament starts. It's like a gala of all the combatants.
Let me just ask you, in a way, because I know you can't possibly answer this without spoiling things. I flipped to the last page of Marauders, and I was like, oh my God. Something big happens there.
Oh, I haven't actually finished Marauders yet. So
okay, well, then I will not say what it is. I wasn't going to say what it was anyway, but I was just like, how does that work?
Interesting.
Yeah. All right, well, to be discussed later then.
Cool.
All right, that'll take care of comics for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some TV and possibly some movies. Okay, so we have to talk about The Mandalorian, because The Mandalorian is back, and spoilers if you haven't seen the season 2 opener, but we're going to talk about it.
This is the way.
I loved this. I'm not crazy, right? The previous episodes, weren't they 30 minutes? Was this double the length?
I think they varied from like 35 to 45. It just depended
on...
This was
like almost an hour long.
Yeah, this one was definitely longer. It was like their opener.
I think they like thinking back on that very first episode, I think it was like 45 minutes.
Oh, man, I thought it was a quick... Like,
I was thinking they were mostly like that long.
Some were pretty quick.
I thought they were all shorter. But anyway, this is... he's back to Tatooine.
He's specifically on the hunt for...
Well, in the opening, he was not on Tatooine. He was looking for...
He's looking for Mandalorians.
Looking for Mandalorians and going to a world where there was, like, essentially, like, a fight club.
It was like Gamorrean fights.
Yeah, Gamorrean fights.
With the vibro axes. That was cool.
That was really cool.
And John Leguizamo voicing a one-eyed alien who was a Stevie and trying to...
That's who it was.
They tried to steal his armor, and it didn't go so well.
I just looked this up, by the way. The running time is listed as 31 to 52 minutes is the series. Anyway, so clearly it varies.
I did not catch that was John Leguizamo.
I noticed his name in the credits, and I was like, I hadn't picked up who he was, so I was like, was it the bartender later?
The voice was super familiar, and I'm like, I know this guy. Who is this? And then when I saw the character at the end, I'm like, oh, that's who that was.
I thought the opening fight scene was great.
Yep.
Baby Yoda shielding himself because he knew the shit was about to go down.
It was kind of like a little suggestion that they'd been together long enough that he's knows this. What's funny, though, is much like the very first episode for me, the kind of traditional he's a badass stuff didn't super interest me. I'm not really feeling this episode. And just like the first one, maybe about 15, 20 minutes in, that's when like things started kind of mixing it up. And that's when I sort of fell for it.
What's funny, Dave, is because you are not the TV aficionado that like Nick and I are. Is? R? Am?
B.
R?
Nick and I B. sometimes it'd be that way. You did not have the same reaction when the Marshall showed up.
Talk about like recognition of voices. Like the second he uttered a word, I was like, "Holy shit, that's Timothy Oliphant!"
Timothy Oliphant. played a federal marshal in Justified.
Yes.
Yeah, for about 10 minutes, I was like, "Oh, it's that guy from Deadwood, it's Timothy Oliphant," and I was like, "Oh no, it's not him." And then I was like, "Is it?" So yeah, I was like, I caught it, but I wasn't sure. It was
the second he showed up in that voice.
Did y'all know he was going to be in it?
No,
they had told us.
I did not remember
at all.
I didn't
remember until he showed up. When he showed up, I'm like, oh, that's right.
I had not heard that.
So here's the sort of big spoilerish thing: is he's looking for a supposed Mandalorian on Tatooine in one of the, not Mos Eisley, not Mos Espa, but a smaller...
Little tiny nowhere
town. And this guy comes into the bar that he's asking about it, and it's like, it's what is clearly recognizable as Boba Fett's armor.
With a dent in the forehead.
With a dent in the forehead, but also a, slightly different colors, the clothing under it was different color. Yeah. It was red instead of green.
Yeah.
And... it's not Boba Fett.
Well, instantly recognizable as not Boba Fett. He wasn't wearing all the armor. He just liked the chest piece and the bat and the
yeah.
But talk about a fan's dream of. I get to be on a Star Wars show. I get to be in Boba Fett's armor.
Yeah.
And the way he played him, too, where he just, like, he sits down. I love the bit where he sits down and takes off the helmet. And you can tell Mondo is just horrified.
Yeah.
He's like, this guy's not a Mandalorian. He just took his helmet off. And I like that he basically, he takes the drinks. He's like, yeah, I know. You're going to kill me, or I'm going to kill you. So why not just start this?
This is the kind of hard-ass moments that I like that feel like old Sergio Leone Westerns.
Yeah.
Where they're, like, kind of unforgiving. And yeah. I'm like, oh, man, how cool is it? This guy is just like, well, I guess this is the day I die or kill you. He wasn't like, and yet, nobody got kind of punked out in there, yep. And which is something that they do often on the show, which is the Mandalorian can get his ass kicked at times, and yet he's obviously a badass, but it's kind of cool when somebody sometimes gets the drop on him.
The Dark Horse winner of this episode, however, for me at least, were the Tusken Raiders.
They're Tusken Raiders where they made them sort of out of the indigenous peoples of Tatooine.
Yeah, I just loved every minute we got to spend with them because...
Yeah, they were cool.
Because in the first Star Wars, you get, what, like 3 minutes with them,
and
essentially?
They're just generic bad guys.
They're generic bad guys.
They are, comparatively, the way Indians, Native Americans, were depicted in, like, 50s and 60s Westerns before they started getting a little more sophisticated about it, arguably very slowly. And so this is though, upgrading them in the same way that Native American portrayals
but here
were.
We learned that they have a language of, like, grunts and hand gestures.
Right. We know that behind the scenes that they actually got someone who knew America, who was a deaf actor who knew ASL, to portray their sign language.
And I love that Mandalorian knows the language.
Yeah.
Why he
yeah.
knows Tusken Raider, who knows?
Just a little behind the scenes thing. And
that's
a
payoff too, by the way, because last time he was on Tatooine, he bartered with them for that's a payoff.
That's right. And, you know, it does have that kind of, like, barking sound that they do in there. But, like, I noticed that they didn't treat it, like, in kind of a comical way.
Yeah.
Which, admittedly, they still do with Jawas sometimes.
Yeah.
They're always slightly comic relief-y. But, like, the Tusken Raiders were treated seriously. It was kind of acknowledged that they are kind of a mixture of good and bad. So ultimately, this episode is about the Marshal, who should not be wearing no Mandalorian armor according to their code if he is not a Mandalorian.
Yep.
But having to team up with the Mandalorian, they decide that they will postpone their fight.
The town has to team up with the Tusken Raiders to take out something even greater.
This is like one of the most, like, kind of, in some ways, it's like one of the most simplest forms of being a crowd pleaser.
Yep.
Like, arguably, it's like a trope. It could be cheesy.
Yep.
And yet they played it so well.
It's done perfectly.
And it
was extremely satisfying. Again, it reminds you how, like, old story tropes can be super satisfying when they're done without, like, being stupid.
Also, the music's great.
Yep.
The music, too. And it's got that big finale.
Right. We get to see a crate dragon, the likes of which we have never seen before.
Well, they're teaming up and going up against the crate dragon that's living in the dead remains of a Sarlacc pit.
Yeah.
Which I was like, I didn't know Star Wars lore and knew that there were multiple Sarlacc pits.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
But, yes, the crate dragon is amazing in this.
Yeah, they make him, like I was saying earlier, in one of the old Star Wars video games, like the Jedi Knight type game, first-person games from the 90s, I know I fought a crate dragon in one of them, and I think he was, like, about 20 feet long, and just, it was, you know, it was a boss fight, but it was still 20 feet long.
But this feels like a...
He's like a dune sandworm.
On the level of, like, Shadow of the Colossus or something like that.
The fight is, like, an extended, like, I don't know, 10 or 15 minute long affair.
You think they've got one thing, then they don't.
And no one gets punked out.
Nope.
I mean, essentially, the Krayt Dragon's awesome. Can only be hurt in certain ways.
Oh, yeah.
Mandalorian and the...
Banthas had a bad day. And some of the...
Not all the Banthas.
Both Tusken Raiders and Human Settlers, I think, they had a rough day, too.
Some get acided.
Oh, yeah.
That acid was pretty mean.
Yeah, Jesus. And then there's, like, a big, cool ending reveal that we're giving spoilers away anyway. It is, like, the Boba Fett.
Yep.
At that point, I was, like, in the episode, I'm like, okay, I think they as much as said that he's dead, but they've created this satisfying new character.
Yep.
And so I was okay with it. But then they, like, kind of did a neat thing where it's, like, especially if you're a Fett fan, which was revealed that he is, like, seems to be alive, kind of scarred, and
Fett.
Living as, like, a nomad, like, out in the desert.
Didn't he have, like, Tusken Raider weaponry and stuff?
Did,
like, he had, like, killing...
he had one of the long rifles and one of the Gaffy sticks.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a perfect way to have your kicking it, too, because, like you, Dave, I was like, oh, I guess they. This is how the Boba Fett armor comes in. That's kind of cool.
We're gonna go flashback in a couple episodes to when Boba Fett runs afoul of the Jawas that stole his armor, because that's not gonna go well for them.
Probably.
Maybe, although like he could be a changed person. He's like been out in the desert for what, a decade or two?
I don't know. Yeah. Every portrayal that I've seen is. Boba Fett is, he's as driven as the Mandalorian is.
It's a long time to be, yep. That's a time that people can become spiritual in.
Right, sometimes you just take a year and you become a courier and lose
like
all
the time.
Like,
how long was
Starfleet.
He in the belly of a Sarlacc?
I mean, I guess we'll find out.
I guess.
That could change it too.
But that does take us to Star Trek Discovery, speaking of, like, the time that, because, like, he had a couple decades. Michael Burnham has a year,
yep.
And she completely went native.
True.
Right. She, So yeah, we're moving to Star Trek Discovery now, which also had it's on its third episode.
Yep.
It's a good time for both fandoms.
Yeah, yep. For sure.
At the end of the previous episode, she was reunited with the crew of the Discovery, only to reveal that she had arrived in the future a year ahead of them. So she's already been there a year. She's got a cool new hairstyle,
yep.
And seems kind of more chill. She's hanging out with her Book,
yep.
A guy who's a kind of courier, which is kind of smuggler-ish, but like not smugglers. It doesn't have necessarily that negative connotation.
They're not unlike the guys in Firefly. They got a little Firefly in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we know that he kind of has a scoundrel vibe to him, but a definite heart of gold.
Yeah.
And we find out that she has just been literally working alongside him.
Yep.
And also,
they officially make Saru captain.
Yeah, that was cool. In a really neat sequence. He says, well, we can, you know, what, discuss this or whatever.
Yeah.
And very I was very pleased at how they did this. She
yeah.
said, like, she's like, it's you. It's always been you.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that fits the whole history. It doesn't, I think, reflect poorly on her in any way, because she had not, for all her qualities, it seems like being a leader is not something she ever really sought quite.
No.
And I love the scene towards the end where they're in the captain's quarters and Saru's putting up the telescope that
George way back
the
when.
Original Georgiou, the real Georgiou game.
Not evil Georgiou.
Yeah.
The Georgiou got eaten.
Yeah.
And anyway, in the course of the episode, they end up traveling back to Earth, and this was a kind of a neat inversion of Star Trek themes. In a lot of ways, it was a classic Star Trek episode in the sense that they went to a planet which had troubles and backwards thinking and helped them resolve their problems or get started resolving them.
Yep.
Only in this case, that backwards planet was Earth.
Yeah, I loved seeing a sort of Earth that had degraded to a planetary defense force instead of being part of a Federation.
Yep.
It was interesting.
Yeah. I've heard a little dissent about Michael Burnham, like, immediately kind of betraying sort of Saru and putting him in this awkward situation because she had to run a crazy gambit.
But I like that Saru knew. He knew that basically Burnham would never do anything to jeopardize the crew.
Yeah.
So he trusts her regardless of going
against... I liked that thematically. This seemed like the kind of thing that had, like, there's like a dozen ways it could have fallen apart with just like one sort of bad guess as to what she was doing.
I mean, Burnham has never outgrown the, I need to do a mutiny? I will do a mutiny.
Yeah, she did start the Klingon War.
She's somewhat impulsive.
Yeah.
Actually, didn't she... Did they stop her before she could, like, bloody the Klingons' noses?
They do.
Yeah.
So in a way, like, she didn't get to try her plan.
No, but she will always, if she views something as being the right course of action, she will always do it.
Yeah, what would you say? In D&D, is she chaotic good?
Yeah,
a little bit chaotic.
Weirdly, although she would think she would be kind of lawful as a Vulcan, but her actions are actually more chaotic.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's an introduction of their first, non-binary character?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's it? Adira is her name.
The reveal of the, of it being a,
That was cool.
I like yelled out loud. I was like, that's so cool.
Well, so their whole thing on getting to Earth to talk to, you know, like in zombie movies when everything is going bad, but there's like some station that like that's like we're an army base in Arkansas.
Yeah.
If you get to us, we can provide shelter.
Starfleet,
by the way, half the time is a trap.
Yeah,
a Starfleet captain had sent out sort of
an admiral message. Yeah, and since it was so hard to get around like the distances, but not now with the Discovery. Which, by the way, I have a feeling that them sharing that technology is going to be how they solve the problem of the future being having no dilithium.
If they everyone starts using spore drives?
Yep. The spore drive is the Starship equivalent of the personal transporters that people have.
Yeah. I was trying to remember this. Why is Stamets so unique? Because he is unique in a way.
He's a mycologist. He's but
they gave him the implants and stuff.
But is he the only one who can have that implant?
I think he's the only one who has had it done, and it was like I don't know if it like used a lot of
it's
resources
so
risky, or something.
I think.
Yeah, I think the deal is he's the only person that it's ever been created for. I don't know if there's a reason why they couldn't do it again if they wanted.
Because the ultimate him bonding with it and time jumping was the reason they went to the mirror universe in the first place.
Yeah.
So it is a definitely risky thing.
But that's because
Lorca pushed him to do something.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I forgot about that.
It turns out that Admiral did, I guess, exist. And now continues to exist in its because the symbiont, I think is what they call him there, in him is now in another person named Adira, who is a teenager and has somebody. What they said it was a combination somewhere between like Wesley Crusher and God, who was it? It was like another young Star Trek character, not Jake from DS9, she's like super smart, knows it, and inquisitive. She actually sort of sabotaged the Earth Defense Force just to poke around on their ship.
Yeah,
the sequences with her and Stamets were really good.
Yeah, that seems like they're gonna have a good chemistry. Somebody did point out he kind of revealed the spore drive to her kind of quickly.
Easily, yeah.
But then I saw somebody else, this was when we were doing our podcast, and somebody mentioned that criticism, and I saw somebody answer and saying that basically he felt like that they think that she probably knew what the deal was, had inferred it because she's so smart, and he was just filling in the gaps.
Yeah, I think so.
Also, Stamets is—he's not a secretive kind of guy. He doesn't. I don't think he's like that kind of guy.
I guess true. They might have entrusted this deep secret to the wrong person.
Yeah. I don't think any of the Star Trek crew are like villainous in nature or that kind of thing.
In fact, arguably. Saru's lied to the Earth Defense Force initially. They just had a real quick cover story that they were like a legacy ship.
Yeah.
And like it fell apart instantly.
Yeah.
And it was kind of cool because their personal transporters, we realized that they were at red alert. That means shields are up. Traditionally, you can't beam through shields.
Oh, that's right.
Future people don't give a crap about that. They just insta beamed onto his deck and they're like, all right, we're inspecting you. And he's kind of like, okay. But yeah, he wasn't a very good liar, have to say.
I don't think any of them are.
Yeah.
Except for Burnham, maybe.
We'll see how much they have to keep it up in the future. But this was actually my favorite episode overall of the new season so far.
It was mine, too.
I really liked it. I still think the first one was my favorite episode back. So.
Fair enough. Nick thinks you're a dum-dum, but okay.
All right. We're going to do horror roundup. We're actually running a little out of time, so maybe that some other time.
We've all been watching a lot of spooky stuff for Halloween.
Yeah, I watched 27, which is a lot for me. And Nick, you watched how many?
52,
think. 52.
Yeah.
Twice as many as me, almost. all right. So that'll do it for us this week. And until next time,
Yo Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.